and just keep plugging along there. If you get too far behind, don't worry about it. You know, just say, okay, I'm declaring my own jubilee, and we'll start next week, you know, with the next reading. Our intent, of course, is to read the entire Bible in the course of 18 months, but that is a daunting task. And so if you only get three-quarters of it read in 18 months, then you've read more than what? If there's 300 million people in America, that would be more than about 299,999,999 other people. So you should feel pretty good about yourself, really, is what you should. So today we have the first 15 chapters of the book of Leviticus. And thought about it quite a bit, decided that it really was not much purpose in my trying to put together a bunch of charts for this particular kind of material. So I've only got just a couple of photographs, which you've already seen all but one of them. Direct your attention to the screen right here, and remember that what we are looking at in these first 15 chapters, this being our 10th week in the study, is Israel in the wilderness. Israel in the wilderness has been introduced to their God in Exodus. They have been rescued by their God in the person of Moses. They have exited Egypt in the most spectacular manner with miracle after miracle, and that last one, you know, devastating and cataclysmic and horrifying, terrifying to see the death of all firstborn in Egypt. They have pillaged Egypt of gold and silver and other precious commodities, and they have gone out into this wilderness now where on a daily basis God is feeding them miraculously with manna, and he is appearing before them in what is called the Shekinah. The Shekinah is a pillar of cloud by day and what by night? Fire by night. It was a most impressive thing. And it had, you know, as its nexus, the tabernacle, which they've just completed building as we now roll on into the book of Leviticus. You read the transition there, and I used it last week as well. You'll find that there's only about 6 weeks during which all the events of the book of Leviticus take place. So there's a tremendous amount of material in the book of Leviticus, but all of it was accomplished in a very short period of time. And the tabernacle then that Exodus spends much time discussing has been built. And today we're going to see that it is consecrated and the sacrifices begin. The priests begin what will be, for the rest of Israel's history under the law, their sacrificial system, which does in fact have elements that are similar to other religions and other nations on the world at that time and before that time, because the idea of sacrifice for sin, God had introduced going all the way back to Adam and Eve and their immediate descendants. And so all nations have a sense that there is a God. All nations have a sense of sin. All nations have a sense of needing to atone for those sins somehow. And so on occasion, you'll see similarities between what God is telling his people to do and what other people are doing. Always, the gold standard, the real standard, the truth, is that which we read in our Bibles for these Jews. So, by tribes, they will be camping around that tabernacle. I'll show you some of those schematics. They were always in the same relationship to each other. And here at the foot of Mount Sinai, they built the tabernacle. They're about to begin that sacrificial system. Now you all know my wife and how bloodthirsty that she is. So she came up to me today and she says, you know, what you really need is a picture that shows some of the blood. And that because there was a lot of it. And you know, I'm giving her a hard time, you understand. So when I get home, I'll get my hard time. But she was right. And I had thought about that myself this week, and so what I'll be leaving up on the screen today as we're going through these chapters is this very photograph, which is an overview, an aerial view of the tabernacle after its completion with four different coverings right there, a veil that nobody could pass through, save the priest, and another one inside for the last third, and only the high priest could go in once a year. But what you have is a sacrificial altar, which is the first thing you see when, if you were a priest, you were to come in to this area. After that, between that altar and that first veil of the tabernacle itself, is what is called the laver. And sacrifices, that is, the killing of a wide variety of different kinds of animals so that their hide and their meat and their bones might be burned or disposed of in very particular manner is taking place through the priest. They're making the actual offering. This blood is not only being spilled next to this altar, but it is also going, as you saw, to be applied to the priests themselves and their garments, as well as to the tabernacle itself. Hebrews will tell us that almost all things are cleansed by what? Blood. The only reason the Hebrew letter says it's almost all things is because the only thing it was not cleansed by blood was pottery. The clay pot, which would be porous, and if you were to put blood on them, you know, you would then run a risk, actually, of, you know, infection and disease and stuff. You know, it's a bad thing. You'd want to have blood that would get inside of it. So the only thing that is not cleansed by blood was the pottery there. But blood, rivers and oceans of blood is the picture that God is portraying to these people as the atonement for sin. Hopefully, after Exodus, but particularly in these 15 chapters and what we'll be seeing in succeeding books of Moses, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, is that these people are being impressed not just with blood. God's not just gory. It's not that he had a bloodlust. What is all that blood teaching them? What does it represent? What is it telling them? It's the value of what? The value of? Sin. It's the value of sin. Now, because it is the value of life, it is the highest value there is, then we are given to understand that that life must be sacrificed to atone for sin. Life is the most valuable of all things. When you commit a sin, you have not just done something that is slight. You may have done something that is common, but it is not something that you should ever take as a given. Well, everybody sins. How many times have you heard people say that? Oh, well, I'm not perfect. Well, good for you. Like, that was news. But when people say that, they say it as an excuse. Since nobody's perfect, then do I have to even try? That's the implication when they say that. In a system like this, do you get the point that you do not want to sin? You sure do. Because the loss of your livestock is very, very expensive and time-consuming and just, you know, problematic. And so you're finding out on many different levels that the cost of sin is horrific. It is awful to behold in a sacrificial system. It is endless in a sacrificial system. And it is, you know, expensive in both energy as well as financially. So that these priests, this was the bloodiest picture I could find for you tonight, you know, these priests are involved in a most gruesome thing that unless you were born in third generation family of butchers, you don't find very comfortable to have to participate in. Now, yes, it was a different time. And yes, people did slaughter their own animals. And so today, you know, we go to Safeway and we find a prepackaged in plastic. And so we're kind of farther removed maybe than they were, but nonetheless, it is dirty work. And it is heavy work. And so in this sacrificial system, now bear in mind that this particular illustration is from the time of Solomon's temple, so it's up the tabernacle in the background. And I think they have greatly oversized, you know, what they thought that actual altar looked like. But nonetheless, these butcher tables and the actual slaughtering of the animals was taking place on a daily basis so that the people would learn that sin is ghastly and costly. It is a thing to be avoided at all costs. So now I'm just going to leave this photograph up. You know, for the rest of the class, and then I'm just going to direct you to the scriptures. Going to read a lot of scripture tonight as we see then the inauguration of this sacrificial, and most particularly a priestly system. So I trust by now you've read the transition. I'm going to skip on that. If you do not have one of the narrated Bible, not narrated, but chronological Bible, anybody here doesn't have one of the chronological Bibles? We've got a new budget. Anytime you need a chronological, you forget yours or something, you know, we've got a stack of them over here. If you don't have one tonight, please, you know, come on up and get one. But mostly we're just looking at the Bible tonight. So come on into Leviticus. Bill, do you have a hand up? Yeah, there are certain things that there will be no substitution for. There's not going to be a substitution for the consecration of these priests. Certainly, Day of Atonement, the nation can afford, you know, those sacrifices. Now, but it is an act of mercy. And we see it, of course, played out in the birth of Jesus, that there were some for whom even a goat or a lamb was more, you know, than they could handle. As we get deeper into the law, we can learn about gleaning. We're going to learn about leaving, you know, the edges of your field so that the impoverished can come and take, you know, grain to sustain life. We're going to learn about a voluntary slavery for the impoverished who could enter into slavery willingly because they weren't making it on their own, and they could then be cared for by someone who had been more successful, you know, financially. And so you're going to find a constant information as God deals with the fact that there's a wide range of human experience. And that being, I don't know if victim is the right word, but there's a whole lot of people who, through no fault whatsoever of their own, you know, have not succeeded in life. Circumstances are against them. Time and chance overtake Saul, as we studied in the Ecclesiastic, in the letter of Ecclesiastes. So I hope I'm getting to your point, but yes, there are substitutions available for the impoverished who really cannot do it. But there are certain sacrifices that have to do with God and the priesthood and all that. There's no substitute. Okay, so just going to leave this up. Let's try to imagine now that this ground is going to be stained and soaked and sloppy with blood is what it's going to be. And remember that in this layout now, and it'll be so for Solomon's temple and then for Herod's that will come after it, that if you stand and face this doorway to the tabernacle right here, the outer curtain screen, if you stand and face it, what direction are you looking?
West.
As you stand and face it, you are looking west. A sunrise, if the curtain were open, a sunrise light beams, you know, would go directly in there. So it is oriented from east to west. So I'm leaving this up so you remember when you have a reference then that says north side of the altar, for instance, you'll be able to say, oh, okay, well now I can see, you know, the blood being poured out on the north side of the altar. So let's come now to Leviticus. Now I said we're going to do a lot of reading here tonight, but we're going to start then with verses 1 through 9. Leviticus 1:1. The Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tabernacle of meeting, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, of the herd, and of the flock. If his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, so cattle, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. So where do you bring your animal? Look at the screen. You bring it to that doorway in the lower left corner. And then it says in verse 4, then he shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. Now, what's the first word in verse 5? He, who's the only person that's being talked about? The sinner who has brought his offering.
That's the he. He shall kill the bull before the Lord. And the priests, Aaron's sons, shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood all around on the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Okay? So the altar's by the door of the tabernacle. The priests are on this side. What have you done right here? You killed it. You didn't just leave it up and say, oh, I don't want to see that. It's ugly. You priests take care of it. When you sin, you pay for it. You've either bought or brought the animal, and then you killed it. And then the priest takes the blood, and he begins to make the atonement for the part that is his responsibility. So, you've brought up the animal, you've laid your hand on it, then you've killed it. Verse 5, he shall kill a bull before the Lord, and the priest Aaron's son shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood all around on the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And he, and that's now the priest, shall skin the burnt offering and cut it into its pieces. The sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and lay the wood in order on the fire. Then the priest, Aaron's sons, shall lay the parts, the head and the fat, in order on the wood that is on the fire upon the altar. But he shall wash its entrails and its legs with water. And the priest shall burn all on the altar as a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. You bring your offering, you lay your hand, you kill it, and you give it to the priest. In 5, you are introduced to the priests, Aaron's sons. They bring the blood, sprinkle it all around the altar. At that point, you've got a new noun, and pronouns refer to the closest antecedent. That's why I use the he in 6 to represent the priests. But you're absolutely right, and I struggled with that too. And I really don't know how to answer the question. So maybe it was the guy, you know, again. But the rule in the grammar is closest antecedent, and the priest had been introduced. So that's why I made the switch. But good for you. I went through exactly the same thing. Instead of that, where's that he goes back to the other?
But because it said it goes back to talking about the priest, Aaron's son. And the priest only took the blood, so left the animal. So it would, to me, like,
and it may be, I'm not going to fight it because I wound up ambivalent on the thing. And I hope everybody heard what they're saying. I'm not sure. Okay, well, hold on a second, Carol, I'll get you a second. But let's look at it again so everybody sees what's going on. Okay, in verse 4, the only person we've been talking about is the one that brings the animal, free will. He shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering. Anybody think that's a priest? Absolutely not. And it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. He shall kill the bull before the Lord. Now, I'm thinking the grammar requires that he is still the guy that brought it. And now the priests are introduced. Aaron's sons bring the blood and sprinkle the blood around the altar. So apparently they've gone through the curtain now into the altar. And that's where we are. And he shall skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces in verse 6. Did the he go back to the previous he? And was the Aaron and the priest every time going to be Aaron and priest, and the he will go back to the guy that brought it? That's what we're wrestling with, and I don't know how to resolve it. The sons of Aaron, the priest in 7, shall put fire on the altar and lay the wood in order on the fire, and then the priest Aaron's son shall lay the parts, the head and the fat, in order on the wood that's on the fire upon the altar. But he, I think it's got to be the priest, shall wash his entrails and his legs with water, and the priest shall burn them on the altar. So I don't know how to resolve it, but that's what I think happens. And then I would say, what we did in Exodus, could you build a tabernacle today? You have very particular information about how to do it. Can you do it? No. Why? What did it require to build it? Inspired artisans, you know, to do that. Now, Moses is informing these men. Do you suppose that he never had a single conversation with them and all he did was write this down, hand it to him and said, okay, we get it? I don't think so.
I think he had a whole lot of elaboration and explanation and teaching going on. And once again, I don't think you could duplicate these sacrifices unless you had what to explain it. Moses or one of the preceding priests who'd been doing it for years. So great questions. Don't know how to answer it. Did the best I could with the pronouns, but it goes the other way. Either way, are you personally involved in your sacrifice? You betcha. You paid for it, you brought it, you laid your hands on it. Apparently you killed it. What's the only thing you can't do? You can't go on the other side of this curtain and be involved in the application of this blood, at which point it's actually, you know, accomplishing atonement. Secondly, can you go in here and lay your animal on the fire?
No.
It's going to have to be burned, but the priest is going to have to do it. I'm sorry, Carol, I held you up for so long. What you got? Okay.
My point was that you can't go inside, so I guess they could have skinned the animal outside and taken pieces in or whatever.
There you go. And bear in mind, it's not just kill the animal and heft it up on the fire. What do you have to do to the animal? You've got to dismantle this thing. You've got to skin it and cut it up. I mean, we're going to see a lot of handling of this bloody meat, you know, as a matter of fact. Now, that's offering number one, and we've only covered 9 verses. Offering number two in verse 10. If his offering is of the flocks of the sheep or of the goats, as a burnt sacrifice, he shall bring a male without blemish. He shall kill it on the north side of the altar before the Lord. And the priests, Aaron's sons, shall sprinkle its blood all around on the altar. Now the north side is the right side. We're facing west, like I am now. North is on the right-hand side. It says on the right-hand side of the altar, but are you inside here? So apparently you should also, if I'm understanding this correctly, imagine an awful lot of blood being shed out here too. You can't even approach this thing without seeing the ground sloppy with blood. It is blood that is the most preeminent thing for you to understand when it comes to sin. It requires the life of the animal. Bill?
Yeah. On the up in verse 3, it says at the door of the tabernacle. Now, is the fence of the tabernacle, is it?
No. The tabernacle is just this, and the curtains are a fence.
So,
that's tabernacle for meeting.
Okay, it says he shall offer it at the door of the tabernacle.
Okay, well, yes, but this is the door of the tabernacle enclosure. So I don't understand anybody but priests being inside the enclosure. Okay, and then again, if I'm outside this fence, am I still on the north side of the altar? I'm still on the north side of the altar. And so I don't have to be inside the fence to be on the north side of the altar. Do I have to be here to be at the door of the tabernacle? If this is the veil, that's the door of the tabernacle. Do I have to be standing right here? If I'm standing out here, am I still at the door of the tabernacle? Yeah, I'm at the entryway, you know, to the tabernacle. Okay? And I mean, it's a lot like this deal right here. If I'm at the door of the assembly hall, I can be in the parking lot. I've come to the door of our meeting place. Or I can be right there at those double doors. Either way, I've come to the door of our meeting place. So, again, I can't duplicate it. I appreciate this interest because it is interesting. And yet it is dry reading. I think Bill was the first one to declare that. Okay? And so there's a great temptation to just read very quickly through this. You know, because one doesn't matter to me, you know, and it's repetitious and all the rest of that. Well, what you're finding out right here is if you slow down or maybe read it out loud, stuff will jump out. And you'll activate your brain and you'll start thinking about it. And when you do, that's helpful. It may produce more questions than, you know, it does answers, but it is also helping focus your attention so that you are developing a clearer picture. Even if I can't answer a specific question, you're still focused on all of this. You're growing in your understanding. So a lot of it I can't answer, and I think God intended it that way, as I pointed out with the actual construction. No, I'm sorry, Ron, get a comment.
I was just going to say, it says, he's stopping at door of the tabernacle. It says door of the tabernacle of meeting.
Okay.
Not the tabernacle.
Yeah, great. And when the people, were the people ever called to assemble before the Lord?
Yeah.
So they came to the doorway of the tent of meeting. Does that mean they all stood right in here in this little courtyard?
No.
600,000 men?
No.
No, it just means they came and they gathered so that you could speak, you know, and be heard. Okay, so there is second offering in 10. His offerings of the flocks, burnt sacrifice, made without blemish, he shall kill it on the north side of the altar before the Lord. And the priest Aaron's sons sprinkle its blood all around on the altar. Skip to, 14. And if the burnt sacrifice of his offering to the Lord is of birds, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves or young pigeons. The priest shall bring it to the altar, wring off its head, and burn it on the altar. Who did the killing this time? Sounds like the priest did the wringing. The blood shall be drained out at the side of the altar, and he shall remove its crop with its feathers and cast it beside the altar on the east side into the place for ashes. That is going to come up several times. Read again Leviticus 1:16. The priest shall remove the bird's crop with its feathers and cast it beside the altar on the east side into the place for ashes. Now, does that mean they had a giant pile of ashes right here between the entryway and the altar? Don't think so. Once again, it's helping us to understand, if I'm outside this place, that tent, am I still on the north side of the altar? Sure. And if I'm outside this entryway, am I still on the east side of the altar? Yes. Now, if I turn to Leviticus chapter 4 and verse 12, which would be on page 118, left-hand column, verse 12. The whole bull he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place where the ashes are poured out, and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned. They don't have two fires inside this gateway, one here and one right there. And they don't have a big pile of ashes that you have to climb up and through to get in. In fact, we are told that the ashes and this other place of burning is outside what? It's outside the camp. The wrong direction here. Slow down. Flying sickle finger here. There it is. Okay. The camp was huge! Huge! 600,000 men, dead the women, dead the children, dead the animals. Okay? So when you say outside the camp, and we've been told specifically the tribes are camping all the way around it, 360 degrees, then this place of ashes and burning was on the east side, but where? A long hike and outside the camp. So it's nowhere near this. Okay? And it's pretty obvious. If all these people are bringing their animals to sacrifice, what's going to happen real quickly? Well, the tabernacle will be buried 40 feet deep and 2 miles wide. Okay? So what they're doing is they're bringing their sacrifice to God and to his priests. You kill it. They sprinkle the blood. And what is left over that is not consumed, and in addition to this cloud and fire, you have smoke coming up all the time, then you take the offal, O-F-F-A-L, what's left over, and what do? You hike it out of town. And it might be half a mile. Might be a mile. Okay? Now, back to chapter 1. And I really have to pick up the pace here now. Okay, forget chapter 1. There is a now grain offering in chapter 2, a peace offering in chapter 3, a sin offering in chapter 4, and I'd like to pick up something there in chapter 4. So come on over, everybody, to chapter 4, verse 1, very lower right-hand corner of 117. Let's talk about this one for a while. There was a lot of repetition with these various sacrifices coming through chapters 1 through 3. But now in chapter 4 and verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel, if a person sins, how? Unintentionally. Then, against any of the commandments of the Lord, in anything which ought not to be done, and does any of them, if the anointed priest sins, bringing guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Lord for his sin, which he has sinned, a young bull without blemish, he shall bring the bull to the door of the tabernacle, he'll lay his hands, kill the bull, you know, there we go. But now, look at verse 5 in Leviticus 4. You have a profoundly important couple of verses here on a totally unrelated subject. But look at chapter 4 and verse 5. Then the anointed priest shall take some of the bull's blood and bring it to the tabernacle of meeting. The priest shall what? His finger. Dip. And this is Hebrew, is the language. When it was translated by Hebrews into the Greek spoken by Jesus and the apostles, guess which word they used for dip? It became baptized. What does it mean? To immerse. The priest will immerse his finger in the blood. And what's the next word? Sprinkle. Totally different word in both Hebrew and Greek. He will sprinkle some of the blood 7 times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. Verse 7, and the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Lord, which is in the tabernacle of meeting. That's now inside, remember. And he shall, what, the remaining blood? Pour. In these two verses, you have the words for immerse, sprinkle, and pour. Are they three interchangeable words that have the identical same meaning, definition, and action? No! They're altogether different. So if somebody came along today and they said, oh, well, you know, baptizing can be sprinkling, pouring, or immersion. And any one of these priests had tried that out, how well would it have gone for them? About as well as it went for two sons of Aaron, whose names were Nadab and Abihu. That's how well that would have gone. Okay? It mattered. And it matters in the Old Testament, it matters in the New. If you just presume to deny what God said and substitute some different meaning. So let's start reading in verse 6. Then the priest shall pour some blood on his finger, immerse some of the blood 7 times before the Lord, and sprinkle the remaining. What would you get out of that? Nonsense. You couldn't even do it. It's not even possible. Some of those are anachronisms. They're not possible. Okay? They're not interchangeable, Old Testament or New. That's why I say, totally unrelated to what we're doing here in Leviticus, but it illustrates Old Testament or New, different concepts. Bill, do you have your hand up? I'm sorry, man, but that's going to be like number 4, and I can't afford it. Okay, ask me after class. I'm way behind now, so everybody, down to verse 11. But the bull's hide and all its flesh with its head and legs, its entrails and offal, the whole bull he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place where the ashes are poured out and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned. At every encampment, brethren, there would be a huge area out here in the east where the ashes of all of this is transported and where another fire was built to consume everything. All right, skipping down now to verse 20. He shall do with the bull as he did with the bull as a sin offering, thus he shall do with it. So the priest shall make atonement for them, and it shall be forgiven them. Then he shall carry the bull outside the camp and burn it as he burned the first bull. It is a sin offering for the assembly. Now note, the repetition is happening, that's for sure, but in verse 13, if the whole congregation of Israel sins, how? Unintentionally. Now, in chapter 1, speak to the children and say, if a person sins unintentionally. Verse 1 of chapter 4. Now, in verse 13, it's if the whole congregation sins unintentionally. What do we have in verse 22? When a ruler has sinned and done something, how? Unintentionally. Now look at 27. If any one of the common people sins, how? Unintentionally. Then it's not a sin, because he didn't mean to. No, what did you find out every time? It's a sin. Even if you didn't consciously decide to do it, and you found in the reading this week, sometimes you didn't even know you've done it. They explained in these preceding verses, then it comes to your attention. Oh, how about that? I didn't know I did that. But you were still guilty of what? Sin.
Job made sacrifices for his children in case they might have sinned.
There you go. So once again, brethren, you can't just shrug your shoulders and slough it off and say, you know, this stuff is not all that important. When God says a thing shall not be done, then what? It shall not be done. And if you do it, is there ever any excuse up to and including, I didn't even know it happened? No, you're still guilty of sin. What do you got to do? Go kill a goat. Okay, every time. Right? Now, chapter 5. If one person sins in hearing the utterance of an oath and is a witness, whether he has seen or known of the matter, if he doesn't tell it, he bears guilt. If a person touches an unclean thing, whether the carcass of an unclean beast or the carcass of unclean livestock, carcass of unclean creeping things, and he's unaware of it, still he is what? He is unclean and guilty. And it goes on in that chapter. Again, they were unaware, but still you are unclean and guilty. Now, just briefly, if you step on a grave, you have just become what? Unclean under the Jewish law. Did you commit a sin in the sense that we think of it? No. And you can step on a grave and not know it. Grass grew over. I didn't even know they were there. Somebody tells me later, whoa, you walked over there? Yeah, I did. Well, don't you know that's a grave? No, I didn't. Well, you're unclean now. So if you're unclean, that does not require that you've consciously decided to rebel against some law of the Lord, but there were certain activities, quite a few of them, where if you just touched an unclean animal, you became unclean. Can you avoid the touching of unclean animals 100% all your life? It can't be done. If an animal dies next to the house, what do you got to do? You got to pick it up and go bury it. You know, you're going to be unclean. Happened all the time. So there is a difference between unclean and then consciously sinning. But all require sacrifices. Now, let's skip over to chapter 7 now. This is going to be just really, 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 really big. And important, maybe make a note right here, either mentally or in your Bible, because the most salient part of what we're about to read in chapter 7 did not appear in this week's reading, chapters 1 through 15. There's additional information for chapter 7 that's over on page 133 in chapter 17. So I want to make sure we get all that hooked together. Get your pencils out and get them ready, because what we're about to read will make more sense and be much more fully understood if you add another passage to it that was not in this week's reading. What I want to do is start in chapter 7 at verse 15. The flesh of the sacrifice, we're talking about peace offerings now, lots of different kinds of offerings. The flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering in 7:15 for thanksgiving shall be eaten the same day it is offered. He shall not leave any of it until morning. But if the sacrifice of his offering is a vow or a voluntary offering, now we've got three different kinds, it shall be eaten the same day when he offers the sacrifice. But on the next day, the remainder of it also may be eaten. The remainder of the flesh of the sacrifice on the third day must be burned with fire. And if any of the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering is eaten at all on the third day, it shall not be accepted, nor shall it be imputed to him. That is, he won't get any benefit from it. It shall be an abomination to him who offers it, and the person who eats of it shall bear guilt. So, certain people, depending on the sacrifice, could eat some of this meat. but only under certain limited circumstances, and if you went beyond the third day, another sin. 19, now here we go. The flesh that touches any unclean thing shall not be eaten. It shall be burned with fire. As for the clean flesh, all who are clean may eat of it. But the person who eats the flesh of the sacrifice of the peace offering that belongs to the Lord while he is unclean, that person shall be cut off from his people. Moreover, the person who touches any unclean, such as human uncleanness, an unclean animal, or an abominable unclean thing, and who eats the flesh of the sacrifice of the peace offering that belongs to the Lord, that person shall be what? Cut off. Now, I have never been able to resolve this, brethren. Jerry, maybe you can help us out tonight, or Ron, or Lenny, or somebody, but I have never been able to sort this out. There are occasions when that phrase, cut off from his people, is stipulated to mean what?
Death.
You kill it. It is a capital offense. On other occasions, it seems to mean not that you must put them to death, but that what instead? Banished forever from the Jews. Bye-bye. Walk out into the wilderness. You're on your own now because you can't camp here with us anymore. Now, in the middle of the Sinai, that's kind of problematic. Okay? But you are not a Jew anymore. You have been cut off from God's people. It'll drive you crazy. From now on, did me anyway, cut off, does it mean put to death, or does it mean banished? And I just won't be able to answer the question. Jerry, do you have something on that?
If a person is cut off from the congregation of Israel while they're in the wilderness, so that he has himself simply
live
alone in the wilderness, that's mighty close to a death sentence in another self.
This pretty well is. My inclination, brethren, is that cut off means put to death the majority of times. Or as Jerry has just suggested, it means good luck that the likelihood of surviving this is zero. You're dead anyway. Okay, so go die slowly because we're not going to do it for you. But he, I think Jerry, there you go.
Different thought entirely, but still death. And sitting here thinking about, and in the course of reading all of this, I thought about it. We put emphasis on the fact that the sinner brings the animal to be sacrificed. He puts his hand on the head of it, and then he kills it. That's just a very simple statement. That killing an animal with nothing but manual tools is not easy. Most animals do not take well to being killed. And it amazes me, just thinking about that, how in the world is that done? So is the animal bound so that it cannot run, cannot kick, and then it slits? Or is it legend? How would they do this?
If I can find the picture, and looking for a bloody picture, I failed to find another one that I'd see, but I just couldn't locate it. In Solomon's temple, much larger area now, they showed in this one a number of posts that had a steel ring mounted in it to which you would cinch the animal. Now it can't move. It's got its head up against the post, you know, and it's just tied.
You can still kick.
That's correct. But if you want to see this done, you can find it online. There are a group of Samaritans today who still kill goats and sheep. And I've seen it done. And it's always done with a knife. It is a quick slashing of the throat, and the animal immediately, you know, gushes enormous amounts of blood. It's a gruesome thing to behold, but I wanted to understand it. I wanted to see it. And you can find it too, if you want to. Okay? But to answer Jerry's question, I was surprised that with just a small sheep, it took two or three guys lying on it, you know, to hold it down, while the man finally, you know, could cut its throat. But it's a pretty simple action. You just need to mobilize the head, and the animal's gone. And that's how they do it. Then where's the blood go? Exactly what we were told. What happens? Spills out all over the ground. Flows. You know, you're walking in the blood to go kill an animal in a location that could be 100 feet in diameter, just sloppy blood. It was something else. Now, with cutoff in mind, if still in chapter 7, here's the big, big point. Verse 26. Moreover, you shall not eat any blood in any of your dwellings, whether of bird or beast. Whoever eats any blood, that person shall be what? They're either banished or they're killed on the spot. Okay? Now, right in your Bible here, C-S-E-E, Leviticus, chapter 17, verses 10 through 14. And then make sure when you get home, you know, put this note in your regular study Bible. This is a Bible we're going to do 18 months, we're going to lay aside. But in your regular study Bible, make sure you've got this note. Now, in this case, it's on page 133, so it was not in this week's reading. But after you've written Leviticus 17, verses 10 through 14, please turn to page 133. You'll see this in your next reading coming right up. Page 133 is Leviticus 17, verse 10. Whatever man of the house of Israel, or of the strangers who dwell among you, who eats any blood, I will set my face against the person who eats blood. I will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul. Therefore I said to the children of Israel, no one among you shall eat blood. Nor shall any stranger who dwells among you eat blood. Whatever man of the children of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you who hunts and catches any animal or bird that may be eaten, he shall pour out its blood and cover it with dust. For it is the life of all flesh. Its blood sustains its life. Therefore I said to the children of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be what? Cut off. Now, many cultures and societies, there is the eating of blood to this day. There are those who argue that this prohibition ended with the Old Testament. I don't think so. I think it's repeated in Acts chapter 15, but that's a study for another day. Be that as it may, at least under the Old Testament, there really isn't any doubt. When you see the lengths that God went to in chapter 17, verses 10 through 14, to explain to you why the blood, and hopefully, you know, you get life is valuable. And that life in God's creation, and therefore in God's mind, is in the blood. Now, we talk about scientific findings and all the rest of that, and how oxygen moves and everything. That's all very, very interesting. Maybe God's getting at that, you know, but it's not a scientific treatise. And God didn't say anything, you know, beyond the fact that the life is in the blood. And everyone knew that. You bleed somebody out, they die. Whether you understand oxygen and waste matter gets carried in the blood system, you know, doesn't matter. You know, you're dead. But blood, brethren, is the atonement. Life must end to cover sin. And the blood of bulls and goats could never what? Never really pay for it. So, what's the picture? Death. Blood. Ghastly, horrifying awfulness is associated with sin. And it's tremendously expensive. Thousands of animals, and sometimes in a single sacrifice, you know, our event would take place. You just can't imagine how much blood that there was. But that was life atoning, representatively, for sin. Okay? Jews got it. And for every sin, who was very personally involved in it? You had to kill it. You had to do it. Now you get up from that action, one would think you would not want to sin anymore. Now brethren, if you get that the Son of God shed His blood, not in a single merciful and almost instantaneous slitting of the throat kind of death, but after hours on the cross, what should you get about committing your next sin? Don't do it. Yes? You would get that out of this. Okay, I've got 5 more minutes now, and only half of the reading to do. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to get it all done, and I never will. But, you know, I want to go now. 2 more things I think maybe I can pull off in these next few minutes. But come to chapter 8. In 8, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take Aaron and his sons with him, the garments, the anointing oil, the bulls, the sin offering, 2 rams, a basket of unleavened bread. Gather all the congregation together at the door of the tabernacle of meeting." Okay? Nobody went beyond that curtain, but they all came. You know. And then, what happens in chapter 8? Many different kinds of sacrifices and blood physically applied to ears and big toes. And who now has been consecrated by blood so that they can officiate at the altar? Aaron and his sons. And who did it all? Moses. Moses, who had spoken with God. Moses, whose face would glow every time he came down from at least 5 trips up that mountain. Moses was the man who consecrated these priests. And so, as you can see in the title on page 123, the priestly ministry begins in chapter 9. Look at chapter 9, verse 22. "And Aaron lifted his hand toward the people, blessed them, and came down from offering the sin offering, the burnt offering, and peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of meeting, and came out and blessed the people. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people, and fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the altar. When all the people saw it, what did they do? They just screamed and threw themselves on their faces." Okay? This religion got through to you. The presence, the magnificence, the power, the awesome glory of your God and how fearful He is. And what do you never want to do to make a God like that mad? Do not sin. Okay? But now, everything is working. Now, brethren, I couldn't quite tell. Hope maybe you spent a few minutes with it. I don't know that we'll ever be able to answer this question either. I can see how the text might allow any of it. But it looks to me like on the same day, what happens in chapter 10? If some other day there doesn't seem to even be any kind of an indication, it's just then this happens. Nadab and Abihu off in a strange fire. And this group, I know you all know that story. We've studied it 99 different ways. Why were they put to death by fire from the Lord? Because they substituted something else. God said, "Do this." We can imagine they said, "Well, He never said not to do that." So they did that instead. I can hear it. God doesn't care. Why should it matter? I don't think it's important. What really matters, you know, is something else. And Nadab and Abihu substituted, you know, this fire that is a different burnable, combustible substance, and they died before the Lord. Now, at the top of page 124, one reading only today from the uninspired commentaries, you know, that are included here, I want you to see something, brethren, that gives you, I think, I fear, some insight into, you know, the authors of the book and kind of their attitude toward the scriptures. By and large, and mostly, it's most commendable. But they are children of their age, and they do reflect something, especially in this couple of paragraphs here, that I thought was just kind of revealing. So looking at the top of page 124, only now if you have a chronological Bible, it's called Right or Wrong Ritual, Life or Death, Leviticus 10, 1 through 7. In the modern Western world, we tend to think of religious rituals as the procedures by which a group of people worship God. It is not a crisis of faith if some part of a ritual is not done exactly right. Now, is that second sentence true in any way, shape, or form? No, it's not true at all. It may be what in the modern Western world a lot of people think, but what was the whole point of chapter 10? That second sentence is not true. It is a crisis of faith if some part of a ritual is not done exactly right. But, continuing, in the ancient world, the ritual was considered something to be performed correctly. But that makes it sound like in today's world you don't have to do it correctly. Anything. Do you? Anything God tells you to do, you better do. Next step, the ritual properly performed was proper religion. But when they say was, what's the implication? Not anymore. But it is. To make an error in the prescribed forms of the rite was not just a mistake, but an act of impiety. Now that is real true. And I can find nothing in my New Testament that would render it untrue. So today, in the modern world, we are just dead wrong. We're living in a culture that thinks you don't have to do things exactly right. So yeah, you know, they may have eaten the Lord's Supper, but that's just a ritual, you know, on the first day of every week. We don't have to do it. We're going to do it quarterly. We're going to change this. We're going to change that. We're going to change something else. Well, yeah, you know, you can't read about instrumental music in worship in the New Testament. But hey, they did it in the old, you know, and we think God really only cares about your heart. And so, you know, we're going to change it. That's just me having to bite you all over again. Now, again, I don't mean to suggest that these men are really, you know, flaming wild heretics and can't believe a word they say. They respect the Bible, but they're also reflecting, you know, the religious culture that they come out of. They came out of a religious culture that is not much inclined to really want to get things exactly right. They came from a liberal religious culture. We don't come from such a culture. We care to do it exactly right. Now I'm going to read the last two paragraphs of that section. Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's sons, were legitimate priests who chose on their own not to follow the ritual that was sanctioned by God. Their deviation appears minor in the eyes of the modern Western world. Yeah, it does. They simply lit their incense censers with a fire from an unapproved source. But for this breach of worship, they were both destroyed by divine fire. Israelites and Judahites would have understood these deaths as the proper consequence. Should we understand them as the proper consequence today? Well, you bet. The priest was supposed to follow the proper ritual. Who are the priests today in Christianity? We are. And we're still supposed to follow the proper rituals. Since the ritual was the way deity was honored and respected. You don't do it God's way, it is impious. It is dishonorable. It is disrespect. Nadab and Abihu's evil was their decision to determine for themselves right and wrong ways to worship. Even mourning for these dead priests was denied, lest it be seen as condoning their sin. Is it any less evil today to determine for ourselves what is right and wrong in the names we use to refer to God's people, in the conditions that are set forth in order to become one of God's people, in the patterns for worship for God's people, in any other particular that you read in the New Testament? Was the story of Nadab and Abihu intended to be burnt and forgotten after the New Testament was written? No. God is the same, is he not? He cares about the New Testament, though, a lot less than he did the Old. Right? Of course not. So you're going to meet a lot of impious people today who, in the name of the Lord, do exactly what Nadab and Abihu do in their worship, in their church organizations and functionings and everything else you can think of. Not a good idea. Ever. Okay? So again, they're probably good guys. And you saw who they are in my introductory classes. Got a couple of Baptists and Presbyterians, you know, and all. These are not Christians. They're scholars who respect the Bible. Their insights are often profoundly helpful. But they're not Christians for precisely the reasons they just stated. In modern Western culture, they don't think you have to be so specific about following a Bible pattern anymore. Let's not be among them. Okay? Any comment or question? Good night.